Chapter 5. Korea Becomes Two States. Division and War. 1945 to 1953. The Arbitrary Division of Korea. On the night of August 10, 1945, the State War Navy Coordinating Committee instructed Colonel Dean Rusk and Colonel Charles Bonesteel to draw up a proposal to divide Korea into separate Soviet and U.S. occupation zones. Looking at a modest-scale map, the colonels noticed that the 38th parallel divided the country into roughly two equal halves, and that Seoul was just below it in the southern half. They proposed that this be the line separating the two occupation zones. The hastily called meeting carried a sense of urgency. On August 6th, the U.S. had dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima. 2 days later, the Soviet Union had declared war on Japan. Having agreed to do so, within 3 months after the German surrender, Stalin waited right until the deadline. Almost immediately, Soviet forces advanced on the Japanese in Sakhalin, Manchuria, and on their short border with Korea. The Japanese forces, depleted of men and material, quickly gave way. Washington, hoping to keep the entire peninsula from falling to the Soviets, offered to create separate occupation zones, as had been done in Germany and Austria. But since U.S. forces were nowhere near Korea, there was no reason to expect Moscow to agree to halt its advance at the 38th parallel. To the surprise of many, however, Stalin instantly agreed. These odd circumstances were behind Korea's division in two. A temporary act of expediency became a permanent and tragic reality for the Korean people, one that would haunt them for the next three generations. It is unlikely that anyone involved appreciated what they had wrought. One of the world's most ethnically and culturally homogeneous nations, with a history of political unity unbroken for a millennium, was now severed in two. The arbitrary line not only divided a country but separated provinces, valleys, and families. It was not based on any historical, cultural, or geographical distinction. It was just a straight line across a map. Modern history offers, pardon the pun, no parallel case of this happening. Germany was divided, of course, but that country was a collection of little states, and one bigger one, Prussia, which had only been cobbled together by Bismarck in 1871. Korea, by contrast, was an ancient state that had been established back when Germany's forebears were still tribal peoples gathering acorns in the forest. Of course, it did encompass regional differences, but there were fewer of these than in Germany or most other states of its size, and in any case, they had no relation to the boundary between the two Koreas. The demarcation was set by people who knew little about Korea. No Koreans were aware of the decision, and it is unlikely that any would have approved of it. The division of Korea was one of the great tragedies that the 20th century brought to the country, comparable to its annexation by Japan in 1910. In some ways it was worse, as it lasted longer and left deeper scars. Done out of expediency, it was not intended to be permanent, but it became so. Almost all Koreans regarded the division of their country as unacceptable, and almost all, in both North and South, wanted reunification. A brief moment of joy. The end of Japanese rule. On Sunday, August 15, 1945, Koreans were told to gather around the nearest radio to hear an announcement from the emperor. This was most extraordinary, since the remote, godlike Japanese emperor never addressed his subjects. The general public had not even heard his voice. As they listened, few could make out his words, since most Koreans could not understand Japanese well, and those who could had trouble comprehending the archaic form of language the imperial family used. But the message got through. Japan was surrendering. To people isolated by strict censorship and accustomed to hearing only reports of victories, the news came as a shock. They may have known the war was not going well, but they had not expected this. Almost immediately, Koreans broke out in spontaneous celebrations, singing, weeping, and dancing in the streets. Symbols of Japanese authority were destroyed, and the families brought out hidden copies of the Taegukki, the Korean national flag, or improvised them, and proudly displayed them. At night, the landscape was lit by Shinto shrines that Koreans set on fire. Koreans expected the Japanese surrender to result in independence, but the Allies had different ideas. At the Cairo Conference in December 1943, Roosevelt, Churchill, and Chinese leader Chiang Kai-shek agreed that Korea would gain its independence in due course upon the defeat of Japan. When the news of this spread mainly to the Korean exile community, it was assumed that in due course meant immediately. However, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who, like most Americans, knew little about Korea, had proposed that the country be placed under some sort of Allied trusteeship after the fall of the Japanese Empire. Later, he proposed that it be placed under a UN trusteeship for 40 years, until the Koreans were ready for independence, not appreciating the fact that Koreans had many centuries of experience in being an independent state. Stalin agreed, but suggested shortening the period to between 20 and 30 years. Koreans, being unaware of this in 1945, began to prepare for independence within days of the announcement of Japan's surrender, forming people's committees in Seoul and elsewhere. These were ad hoc groups of prominent local citizens of all political views who met to prepare for the restoration of independence and to handle political matters such as ensuring adequate food supplies and avoiding clashes between Koreans and Japanese. Within 2 weeks, people's committees had been formed in all provinces and major cities and towns. In early September, representatives of the various committees declared a Korean People's Republic. Made in Moscow, the new North Korean state. To say that neither the Soviets nor the Americans were prepared for the occupation of Korea would be an understatement. They were totally unprepared. Moscow and Washington simply had not given Korea much thought, and Japan's capitulation came sooner than expected. Neither side even brought Korean-speaking interpreters with them, nor did the military commanders of either occupation zone have clear orders on what they were supposed to do when they arrived. Both occupations were improvised. But the Soviets had a clearer sense of the kind of society they intended to create than the Americans, who seemed to have had no idea of what they expected to accomplish. Because of their proximity, the Soviet forces occupied their zone first. On August 11th, the 25th Red Army crossed the border into northeast Korea. Over the next 2 weeks, they took control over the industrial northeast region, carting off equipment and engaging in unofficial looting. On August 26th, they entered Pyongyang. The Soviets found that the People's Committees were already carrying out many of the functions of local government, so they worked with them. The head of the Pyongyang People's Committee was Cho Manchik, a Christian nationalist and an advocate of nonviolence who served as the nominal leader in the region. But the Soviets were looking for more reliable partners, communists they could work with. The local communists who emerged from hiding or jail had few contacts with Moscow. They took orders from the Korean Communist Party, whose leadership was, rather awkwardly, in the American zone. The Soviets didn't want to work with Christian nationalists and regarded the local communists as unreliable. Furthermore, they desperately needed Russian-speaking Koreans just to communicate with. Into this situation came Kim Il-sung and his partisan comrades. After fleeing to Siberia in 1940, they had become part of the 25th Red Army's 88th Special Reconnaissance Brigade. When the war ended, Kim and his fellow partisans tried without much success to return to Korea. Finally, Kim and 60 of his comrades managed to get a ride on board a ship sailing to the port of Wonsan on the East Sea. On September 19th, they arrived in northern Korea. For Kim, it was the first time he had been in Korea since he was 12. For some of his fellow Manchurian guerrillas, it was the first time ever. Wearing Soviet military uniforms, familiar with the Soviet army, speaking some Russian, and with unimpeachable nationalist credentials, this small group of former Manchurian guerrillas was just what the Soviets were looking for. Although not the most senior member, Kim Il-sung was the best known, and also managed to impress the Russian officers who interviewed him. Having found the leader they needed, they almost immediately began promoting him. The Soviets introduced him to the public by having him deliver the keynote speech at the massive welcoming ceremony for the Red Army they organized on October 14th. From then on, it was clear that the Soviets were preparing Kim for a leadership role. However, Kim Il-sung and his guerrilla companions were not the only Korean communists who were playing important roles. The occupation authorities managed to find hundreds of bilingual Soviet Koreans from all over the USSR who provided technical expertise. Particularly valuable was their familiarity with Soviet government and Communist Party organization. At the same time, thousands of Korean communists returned from China. These so-called Yan'an communists included the prominent leader Kim Tu-pong, who formed the rival New People's Party. At the insistence of the Soviets, this party merged with the North Korean Branch Bureau, as the Korean Communist Party in the North was called. Furthermore, as the Americans and their allies in the South began to crack down on communism, most of the communist leaders there fled north, forming a domestic communist faction under the leadership of Pak Hon-yong. Thus, Kim Il-sung had to share power with many others. But he was still the one the Soviets were promoting. His portrait was hung in public places alongside Stalin's, and composers were instructed to write songs about his heroic deeds as a partisan fighter. The Soviets, however, could not have known what they were creating, a dictatorship with a cult of personality that would outdo that of Stalin, and a dynasty that would long outlast the USSR. At first, Moscow entertained the idea of establishing a unified Korea from the two occupation zones that would be friendly, or at least neutral, rather than establishing a separate government in their sector. But in early 1946, they took steps to create a new Soviet-style state. Carefully managed elections produced a National People's Committee that carried out sweeping reforms. Industries were nationalized. A rather easy step, since most were owned by Japanese who had fled or been repatriated. They instituted an 8-hour workday and a minimum wage. Other laws established equality between men and women and made divorce easy. Mass adult education campaigns reduced illiteracy, and compulsory universal education was enacted. The most significant measure was land reform. In a country where most people were tenant farmers or agricultural laborers, nothing could have done more to win support for the new political and social system the Soviets and their communist allies were establishing. All the property of the big landowners was confiscated. Most landowners fled south of the parallel, and more or less equally distributed to all farmers. Heavy land taxes and the small size of the farms meant that their material existence improved only marginally, but the peasants were now working their own land. With these measures, a radically new society was emerging in the North, one based on equality, in which everyone was to address each other as comrade, in which formerly humble peasants and workers were told they were the new elite of society, and in which the old Yangpan class that had dominated society for many centuries was gone. But it was also a regimented society that brooked no dissent. Protest demonstrations, mostly by Christian groups, were brutally repressed. Writers and artists were enlisted as propaganda agents of the state, and much as had been done in wartime under the Japanese, everyone was mobilized for various campaigns directed toward state goals. An elaborate security apparatus was developed under the direction of former Soviet police officer Peng Hak-se. North Korea soon had all the makings of a Soviet-style totalitarian government except a prison system, political prisoners were simply carted off to the Soviet Union's gulags, and an army. That was created in early 1948, when some of the security forces were converted into the Korean People's Army. Americans create their own Korea. The Americans, like the Soviets, arrived in Korea ill-prepared, lacking interpreters and a coherent plan. Like the Soviets, they had few contacts in the country and were not sure who to work with, and like the Soviets, they lacked clear instructions from their government. But in most other ways, the U.S. occupation was different. Unlike the Soviets, the Americans refused to work with or even acknowledge the People's Committees. They were slower to delegate authority to locals and had real difficulty in finding local leaders they felt comfortable with. Within months, the Soviet administration undertook a clear, orderly, systematic transformation of the country, while the U.S. occupation had a chaotic, confused quality during all of its 3 years. When they arrived in Seoul, the Koreans cheered the American liberators wildly. But their goodwill dissipated immediately when the U.S. military commander, General Hodge, a good soldier but ill-suited for the task of nation-building, ordered that the Koreans continue to obey the Japanese colonial authorities. This was meant only as a temporary measure of expediency to ensure order until the Americans could put their own administration in place. However, Koreans were stunned at being told to obey the oppressors that they had just been liberated from. The Americans quickly realized their mistake and sent the Japanese home, but they never fully regained the trust of the people they had been sent to govern. A major problem for the Americans, much as for the Soviets, was finding people they could work with, and it was one the U.S. never solved satisfactorily. South Korea became a confusing mix of groups competing for power, the communists under Pak Hon-yong, who hoped to work with others to bring about a socialist revolution, various radical and left-leaning groups not affiliated with or willing to work with the communists, the conservative landlords and businessmen, right-wing independence fighter Kim Gu, who returned from China, and some moderates such as Kim Kyu-shi and Ye Woon-hong. The split between moderate and radical nationalists that had emerged in the 1920s came out in the open with liberation. The U.S. occupation authorities outlawed the Korean Communist Party, and most of its members fled to the north. However, both communist-leaning and non-communist radicals continued to stir things up. A wave of labor strikes, student demonstrations, and pent-up grievances of all sorts emerged. Occupational authorities saw the hand of communists everywhere, and the right-wing conservatives who operated the police force arrested tens of thousands, until there were more Koreans in jail for political offenses than there had ever been under the Japanese. The Americans gravitated to the wealthy landlord elite. Some could speak English, and most had enough understanding of Westerners to know how to please their foreign occupiers. They were, of course, also fervently anti-communist. Some of them, such as the industrialist Kim Song-soo, were decent enough people, but they had two strikes against them as plausible leaders of a new Korea. Firstly, most had not only prospered under the Japanese, but had willingly or under pressure actively supported the regime, especially during the war, thus undermining any nationalist credentials they might have had. Besides being tainted as collaborators, they owned the land that the country's millions of poor farmers wished to have and thwarted attempts at land reform. Not only did the Americans align themselves with this elite class, but they appointed Koreans who had served in the Japanese police and military to run the South Korean Police and National Constabulary, the forerunner of the later South Korean Army. This, of course, did little to endear the occupation government to most Koreans. One early candidate for a leader in the South was Syngman Rhee. Well known in Korea, the independence leader from the U.S. had untarnished credentials as an uncompromising opponent of the Japanese and as an articulate spokesman for the independence cause. After Pearl Harbor, Rhee left Hawaii for Washington to lobby for support for Korean independence. At the end of the war, he somehow finagled a ride on General MacArthur's private plane to Seoul, arriving on October 16th. At first, the Americans thought they had found their leader. This was suggested by his formal public introduction by General Hodge. But quickly they found Rhee to be a stubborn, independently-minded old man who was difficult to work with. He was nobody's man but his own. Rhee led a campaign opposing the trusteeship and calling for immediate independence. This caused trouble for the U.S. and only contributed to the atmosphere of disorder. But it served Rhee. He could gain popularity, since everyone hated the idea of a trusteeship, while also demonstrating he was no one's puppet. Conservatives found in Rhee a person they could support and who in turn could protect them from charges of collaboration. So an alliance of Rhee and the conservatives gained the upper hand in the South. With politics polarized between left and right in the South, more moderate leaders, the left-leaning Ye Woon-hyung and right-leaning Kim Kyu-shik, formed the Coalition Committee to create a centrist government. For a moment, the Americans saw hope. especially in the dashing, handsome, well-spoken Ye. But in July 1947, Ye was assassinated by an unknown assailant. Out of desperation, the Americans brought back Se Che Pil, the aging former Kepshin coup leader, as a possible moderate rallying point. Se's return was an extraordinary event, made even more so by the fact that someone who had briefly served as defense minister in 1884 and had led the Independence Club in the 1890s could still be around. Se was not only very old, but dying of cancer. He came home, had a look around in the country he had not seen in over half a century, and returned to the U.S. to die. Thus, with the leftists mostly suppressed, the communist leadership having fled north and the moderates rendered ineffective, the leadership in 1948 passed to Rhee and his conservative backers. Untrustworthy trusteeship. The creation of two Koreas. The original plan was to create a UN trusteeship, but there was no trust on any side. The Americans didn't trust the Soviets didn't trust the Americans, and the Koreans, at least in the South, didn't trust either of them. In December 1945, the U.S., the Soviet Union, China, and Britain met in Moscow to discuss setting up the trusteeship. It was to last 4 to 5 years, realistically reduced from the previous plan of 20 years. An American-Soviet joint commission was created to work out the details. Up to that point, Koreans had known nothing of the secret wartime plan for a UN trusteeship, and they reacted to the news with spontaneous outrage. On both sides of the parallel, massive demonstrations took place. At first, these included the members of the Korean Communist Party, but when Moscow told them to support the plan, they fell in line. The Soviets then used opposition to the trusteeship as an excuse to clamp down on non-communist political groups in their sector. In the South, demonstrations continued, adding to the sense of disorder there and making it hard for the Americans to govern. Meanwhile, nothing was accomplished by the Joint Commission when it met in 1946. A stumbling block was Moscow's stipulation that any political groups that opposed the trusteeship be barred from participating in the self-governing process. Since all political groups, except for the Soviets' communist allies, were adamantly against the idea of trusteeship, this was an obvious non-starter. In reality, by the spring of 1946, it was probably already too late to create a unified governing entity. The border between the two zones was being treated as a permanent one, and the outlines of a separate state in the north were already being established when the Joint Commission met. The body's second meeting the following year also got nowhere, after which the U.S., seeing no progress and wishing to extricate itself from the peninsula, turned the question of independence over to the United Nations. The U.N. formed a temporary committee on Korea, which decided elections would be held in the spring of 1948. When it was clear the Soviets would not cooperate, the U.N. held elections anyway, in the areas that were accessible to them, that is, in the South. This meant there was to be a separate election in the South, which would in all likelihood mean a separate government. Some South Koreans were appalled by the possibility that the division could become permanent. Kim Kyu-shi and others made a desperate last-minute attempt to work out some agreement with the North, but this got nowhere. In May, the elections took place, and a National Assembly was elected in the South. 300 political parties participated, but of course the Communists were absent. In July, the Assembly elected Rhee as president, and with the UN's blessings, the Republic of Korea, ROK, was declared in Seoul on August 15th. Separate preparations for independence took place north of the parallel. A constitution was drawn up for the new state, modeled on the 1936 Soviet Union constitution. In fact, it was drawn up in Moscow by Soviet officials who had it translated from Russian into Korean and then presented it to their Korean clients. The North then carried out its own elections, which they claimed were secretly conducted in the South as well. An assembly met. 2/3 of the delegates were supposedly Southerners and approved of the new government. They then proclaimed the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, DPRK, on September 9th. What is important to bear in mind is that both of these Koreas claimed to be the only legitimate one. In fact, the constitution of the DPRK specified Seoul as the capital. Seoul actually means capital in Korean. Pyongyang was only supposed to be the temporary government headquarters. The new Republic of Korea in the south got off to a bad start. First, Seoul was plunged into darkness when the north cut off its electricity. Almost all of the peninsula's power was generated in the far north. Then the government stumbled into semi-chaos as the executive and legislative branches quarreled. Ri's government was at odds with the National Assembly. It may have elected him, but its largely independent members soon challenged the actions and appointments of their president. A major issue was Ri's use of men who had served as officers in the hated Japanese police force to staff and command his security forces. The commanders of his newly created ROK Army had also been officers in the Japanese Army. One of the top generals was Kim Sokwon, who had headed a special unit to track down Kim Il-sung in the late 1930s. Unable to work with the assembly, Ri often ignored it and ruled in a semi-dictatorial style, using his Japanese-trained police to lock up opponents, who soon filled the jails. He also made use of an army of thugs known as the National Youth Corps, led by Lee Poon-sok. Lee, who was educated in Nazi Germany and later in China, was an admirer of Chiang Kai-shek's blue shirts, which in turn were patterned after Mussolini's black shirts. Under the slogan Nation First, State First, they paraded around and beat up and intimidated anyone who they regarded as a threat to the newly established political order. Ri, meanwhile, saw communist infiltrators everywhere. Schools were purged of teachers, government offices fired civil servants, and institutions of all types dismissed employees suspected of being sympathizers. Protesting students were beaten and jailed. Unrest was greatest in the countryside, which was filled with peasants excited by talk of land reform, but frustrated by the government's failure to move on it. Some rose up in revolt. The worst violence was on Jeju, a beautiful island province that is now a popular vacation spot known as Korea's Hawaii. Local citizens in this rural place staged an armed rebellion, taking advantage of the miles of tunnels and the caches of weapons the Japanese had left behind as a measure for a last-ditch defense of Korea against an Allied invasion that never came. In the appallingly violent struggle that followed, some 10% of the island's 300,000 inhabitants perished before the rebellion was put down. Ri sent in his new army to bring Jeju back under control. In October 1948, just weeks after command of this force was transferred from the Americans to ROK officers, the army was assembled at the port of Yeosu to land on the island. Instead of putting down the revolt, however, the soldiers themselves rebelled. Some waved banners calling for the overthrow of the government. Loyal troops were found who could put down the mutiny, but only after heavy fighting. Some of the rebel soldiers that managed to evade capture became part of the anti-government guerrilla bands that were popping up in the mountains. The re-administration's anti-communism was reinforced by the thousands of former landlords and businessmen, Christians and other conservatives, who had fled from the north and wielded strong political influence. And, of course, there was real fear of the north. For one, its allies, Russia and China, were neighbors, whereas the Americans were far away, and their support was uncertain. Thus, insecurity fed into the anti-communist hysteria. In 1949, the government forced 300,000 former communists, suspected communists, and anyone thought to have loyalties to the North to join the National Guidance Alliance in order to keep them under the watchful eye of the state. Even members of the armed forces were not above suspicion. A young Japanese-trained military officer, Pak Jong-hee, for example, was nearly executed on the grounds of being sympathetic to the communists, but was exonerated. He would serve loyally in the ROK Army, lead a military coup in 1961, and had a staunchly anti-communist government. North Korea took advantage of the turbulence in the south to foment more of it. Pak Hon-young and his fellow southerners trained hundreds of agents to sneak into the ROK and lead or organize revolts. Within a year of its independence, guerrillas were active in several mountainous areas. They also had agents stirring up trouble elsewhere, so Ri's paranoia had a real basis. However, most of the unrest in the south was locally generated. While the South was floundering, the North was consolidating. Kim Il-sung, not yet an absolute ruler, and his partisan comrades shared power with the Yan'an and Soviet Korean leaders, and especially with Pak Hon-young and his fellow domestic communists. They all followed the Soviet blueprint on how to create a modern industrial state backed by military strength. In 1949, they implemented a 2-year economic plan to increase electric generation and industrial production and to construct infrastructure. Propaganda teams traveled to villages and neighborhoods, bringing the goals of the socialist revolution to the people through films and songs. Everyone was organized into state-sponsored women's, youth, farming, and labor organizations, which functioned as a means to recruit voluntary labor for public projects while instilling loyalty to the regime. And real progress was achieved. There was little disorder, since all opposition had been eliminated prior to independence, and the peasants had gotten the land they wanted. Many citizens were genuinely excited about the new progressive state, even if they disliked the mass campaigns and were saddened by the division of the country, which often meant loss of contact with relatives below the parallel. Meanwhile, North Korea was quickly building a powerful Korean People's Army. With the proclamation of the People's Republic of China in 1949, tens of thousands of Koreans who had fought under the Chinese People's Liberation Army began returning to Korea, providing a large corps of experienced fighters. Moscow was generous, equipping it with artillery, tanks, and other weapons. It is not surprising, then, that Kim was confident that reunification under the DPRK was inevitable. Reunification by force. North Korea's invasion of the South. On June 23, 1950, a UN team of observers completed an inspection tour of the 30th parallel. There had been frequent clashes along the border, some instigated by ROK forces, and there was always the fear that war would break out. The UN team reported finding nothing unusual, having apparently totally missed the quiet military buildup of the DPRK forces. 2 days later, on June 25th, North Korea began an artillery barrage, followed by infantry advances. And thus, on that day began what became known to the South Koreans as the June 25th Incident, to the North Koreans as the Great Motherland Liberation War, and to the Americans as the Korean War. Kim Il-sung's plan was to head directly to Seoul. He believed that if that city was captured, the ROK army would begin to collapse. South Koreans would rise up, and in a matter of days the war would be over. Initially, the invasion went as planned. After 2 days, the Korean People's Army, KPA, was in Seoul. South Korea was caught completely by surprise. There was panic in the capital. Soldiers retreated, and thousands of civilians fled in nightmarish scenes of utter chaos. Symbolizing the horror of these hours was the Han Bridge incident. There was only one bridge across the mighty Han River that formed the southern border of the city. ROK forces, in an attempt to slow the advancing forces, blew it up prematurely while it was packed with escaping civilians, killing hundreds of them. Roads became rivers of families heading south ahead of the advancing KPA, men, women, and children moving mostly on foot and carrying whatever they could on their backs. The South Koreans were not the only ones caught completely by surprise. The Americans were as well. At first, they were confused about the reports, but when they realized that a full-scale invasion was underway, they reacted quickly. On June 27th, President Truman ordered General MacArthur, who was busy with the occupation of Japan, to come to the aid of the ROK Army. The Americans went to the UN to ask for a resolution giving them the authority to intervene and received it almost immediately. The Soviet Union, which could have vetoed the resolution, was boycotting the UN in protest of the international body's refusal to allow the representatives of the People's Republic of China to replace the nationalist government seat at the UN. This proved fortunate for the Americans, since there was no obstacle to getting United Nations approval. In fact, the U.S. entered the war under the banner of the UN. Eventually, a number of countries joined the UN effort, including 12,000 British, 8,500 Canadian, 5,000 Turkish, and 5,000 Filipino troops, and a few more from other countries. These allied forces served to support the pretense that this was an international effort. It was in reality an American operation. Truman's decision to enter the war had a profound impact on Korean history. Just as the hastily called meeting in August 1945 led to the division of Korea, the president's hasty decision to intervene made that division permanent. Why did he choose this course of action? North Korea didn't expect an American intervention, and Moscow probably didn't either. Even Ri could not have counted on it. While the Americans couldn't wait to extricate themselves from Korea, and many were willing to write off the regime, Truman felt he and his Democrats could not politically afford to lose Korea. Just a year before, the Chinese nationalist government of Chiang Kai-shek, despite billions in foreign military aid, had fled with the remnants of his army and government to the island of Taiwan. As many Americans saw it, Moscow had just consolidated control over most of Eastern Europe. Now the world's most populous nation could be added to the column of communist advances. The policy of containment appeared to have been undermined from its very inception. So Truman, not wanting to lose yet another country to the Reds, decided to make a stand in Korea. But saving South Korea was not easy. Most U.S. troops were in Europe. The nearest ones at the government's disposal were the occupation forces in Japan, numbering about 100,000. But they were not very combat-ready, and it took a while to mobilize them. When the American forces did arrive on July 5th, they were defeated by the KPA and forced to retreat south. The KPA, meanwhile, was advancing steadily southward. Its main target was Pusan, in the extreme southeast corner of the country, where Rhee's government had fled and was now based. As its fall would mark the effective end of the regime, North Korea's forces were racing there to capture it before American forces could arrive in large numbers. But Kim Il-sung and Park Hon-young's plans did not go as planned. Instead of capitulating after the fall of Seoul, ROK forces put up more resistance than expected, making the conquest of the South slower and more difficult than anticipated. Another problem was the reaction of the people to being liberated by the KPA. As the North Korean forces captured cities and towns, they set up people's committees to govern them. They rounded up suspected ROK officials and class enemies, executing many, and promised to redistribute the land to the farmers. But the liberated Southerners did not react as the North Korean leadership expected. A few students and intellectuals came forward to serve the new political order, but most South Koreans were less than enthusiastic about being liberated. Many were angry that their own people, fellow Koreans from the northern part of the country, were invading them. Others feared what the communists would do. When young men declined to volunteer to serve in the North Korean armed forces, they were drafted against their will. Tens of thousands of these impressed soldiers were forced to retreat with the KPA when it was driven back into North Korea, and most were never heard from by their families again. In short, the brief North Korean occupation mainly generated hatred for the communists rather than support. There were some guerrillas who had fought for the North, but they were mostly the remnants of those who had fought in the mountains before June 1950, not new recruits. All this meant that the KPA was unable to advance fast enough to complete its conquest before the arrival of substantial UN forces. Still, by early August, most of South Korea was under KPA occupation. The South Korean government controlled only a little corner of the southeast within a mere 40-mile radius of Pusan. But it was enough to provide a foothold for the massive numbers of U.S. troops when they arrived. By this time, the Chinese were already becoming alarmed. Mao decided to send troops if the war went really badly, and Pyongyang itself was in danger of falling, and sent out messages to the U.S. to this effect. If the Americans decided to liberate the North, he would bring in volunteers to defend it. Unfortunately, the U.S. had no diplomatic relations with the communist regime in Beijing, so the message was delivered through Indian diplomatic channels, which the Americans did not take seriously. Trapped in the southeast corner of the country, the American military commander, General MacArthur, decided to execute a bold move. Against the advice of many in Washington who thought it too risky, he moved 80,000 Marines and 260 ships and landed them at Incheon, Not an easy feat, since he had to navigate the notoriously tricky seas off the west coast. His forces landed in early September, almost 5 years to the day from the first arrival of American forces in Korea. As planned, the North Koreans were taken by surprise. Within days, the UN forces had fought their way back to Seoul, and by the end of September, the KPA was in disarray. Kim Il-sung, panicking, pleaded to Stalin and Mao to send forces to save his faltering army in the south. His attempt at reunification had clearly failed. Had the Americans and South Koreans stopped at this point, the war would have soon come to an end, and South Korea would be secure. The war had already been a bloody one, with more than 100,000 military and civilian casualties, but this figure was only a tiny fraction of the eventual loss of life in the Korean War. Unfortunately, both MacArthur and Rhee were determined to press onward. For Rhee and his government, it was nearly impossible to stop at this point when the reunification they so passionately desired seemed possible. They had the support of MacArthur, who sought the same total victory and unconditional surrender of the enemy that he had achieved 5 years earlier against Japan. For Truman, while he was less enthusiastic about pressing on with an invasion of the North, a rollback of communism would be a political victory. Therefore, on October 7th, at the request of the U.S., the U.N. passed a vaguely worded resolution that approved the use of U.N. forces to cross the 38th parallel and destroy the KPA forces. 2 days later, MacArthur moved his troops into the DPRK. ROK forces didn't wait. They began crossing over even before they had approval to do so. On October 10th, the first major city in the north, Wonsan, the port where Kim Il-sung had first arrived, fell to South Korean forces. In a radio broadcast, Kim ordered his people to fight to the last drop of blood and then fled to safety near the Chinese border. Within a few days, the swiftly moving UN and ROK forces captured Pyongyang. On October 20th, President Rhee made a triumphal entry into the former North Korean capital. By late November, almost all of the North was under ROK and UN control. Reunification was nearly complete. South Korea's occupation of the North was remarkably similar to the North's brief occupation of the South, and the response from locals was similar as well. ROK forces told the people they were being liberated, but North Koreans showed little enthusiasm for their liberators. Some fled, most were largely passive. While few resisted, not many embraced the new regime. Rhee, furthermore, did little to ingratiate his government with the local population. Thousands were arrested, and the ROK authorities threatened to punish those who had collaborated with the communists. But that, of course, included almost everyone. Worst of all, they announced that illegally appropriated land would have to be given back to the rightful landlords. One could hardly imagine an announcement less likely to win hearts and minds. Meanwhile, Kim Il-sung and his government were still hanging on in Kangye, a small city in the remote, rugged mountain area near the Chinese border. He was advised by Moscow to leave for China, a signal that his Soviet allies were about to abandon him. But he was saved by the Chinese. In late November, MacArthur, promising his men that the war would be over by Christmas, launched the last mopping-up effort to secure the area along the Chinese border. He ignored intelligence reports indicating the Chinese forces, under the guise of Chinese People's Volunteers, that is, they were not official Chinese forces, but supposedly just volunteers, had begun quietly crossing over into North Korea several weeks earlier. On November 27th, the Chinese counterattacked the UN and ROK forces. The Americans were caught as unprepared as the North Koreans had been at Incheon a couple of months earlier. Led by veteran military commander Peng Duhuai, the Chinese advance was rapid and relentless. Once confident of total victory, the UN forces now retreated on all fronts, so rapidly at times it became a rout. On December 6th, the Chinese and North Koreans retook Pyongyang, and on January 4th, they were in Seoul. They continued marching until they reached the 37th parallel, well inside South Korea. Eventually, the Chinese advanced beyond their supply lines, and the UN forces were able to regroup and begin pushing them back. On March 15th, UN forces retook Seoul, which had changed hands 4 times in 9 months. By the summer of 1951, the war stalemated at roughly where it started, along the 38th parallel, with the Chinese and North Koreans holding some territory south of it at the western end toward Seoul, and the UN and South Koreans holding some territory north of it near the east coast. Truman fired MacArthur when he chafed at being denied another try at moving into the north. The Americans had no desire to expand the war. Neither did Mao. He saved his ally, fought the Americans to a draw, and was willing to accept a divided Korea and call it a victory. In July 1951, the two sides began negotiations for a peace settlement. For Kim Il-sung and Syngman Rhee, returning to the status quo was not acceptable, but they had little choice in the matter. Once again, Koreans saw their fate decided by the great powers. Kim, sidelined by the Chinese, was no longer effectively in command of the military situation. Instead, he focused on consolidating his power at home and casting blame for the failure to reunify the country on others. He carried out a number of purges and began rebuilding the Korean Workers' Party by recruiting new members of the rank and file. Rhee was also busy consolidating his power and fending off threats to it. His administration was riddled with corruption. For example, he created the National Defense Corps to mobilize all available men for the war effort, but the organization proved a vehicle for its officers to line their pockets with the military aid funds that were flowing in. Unable to find enough allies in the National Assembly to re-elect him, he declared martial law, had many of the legislators arrested, and intimidated others in sufficient numbers to have them pass a constitutional amendment that allowed for direct election of the president, which, of course, he won. He also created his own party, the Liberal Party, that soon gained a well-deserved reputation for corruption. Throughout the war, the government in Pusan had carried out extrajudicial killings of those suspected of disloyalty, beginning with the initial North Korean invasion. At that time, 30,000 suspected Pyongyang sympathizers were rounded up and nearly 3,000 of them executed as a preventive measure. While Kim and Rhee were eliminating domestic enemies at home, the UN and Chinese carried out talks. Yet despite negotiations that started in July 1951, the war dragged on, largely confined to a narrow strip of land along the border. Frustrated, the U.S. stepped up its bombing of the North. This was accelerated with Operation Pressure Pump in July 1952. Thousands of bombing raids destroyed every possible military and industrial target, including the dams and dikes that irrigated the rice fields. Pyongyang and other northern cities began to look like Hiroshima and Nagasaki after the A-bomb, with only a few buildings standing. More bombs were dropped by the Americans on this little country of hardly more than 8 million than the Allies had dropped on either Germany or the Japanese Empire in World War II. As a result, the North Koreans were forced to move underground. The entire country became a bunker state, with industries, offices, and even living quarters moved to hundreds of miles of tunnels. Nonetheless, civilian casualties in these bombing raids were appallingly high. By 1953, all parties were ready to end the conflict. Newly elected President Eisenhower had promised to end the war, and since the Chinese had achieved what they needed, Mao was ready to end it too. For the Soviets, the war was not so bad. It tied down American forces and lifted some of the pressure on Europe at a relatively low cost to them. The Soviets supplied weaponry, and some of their pilots pretended to be North Koreans and flew DPRK planes, but it was the Chinese, not the Soviets, who supplied the troops. Yet even the Soviets were getting tired of the conflict. And after Stalin's death, in March 1953, were ready to end it. Kim Il-sung, realizing that his hope for reunification had been thwarted, at least for the time being, and needing a respite from American bombing, was ready for the fighting to cease. Only South Korean President Syngman Rhee was opposed to peace. There was less domestic pressure on him to capitulate, since war was now confined to the border, away from the civilian population, so the South was not experiencing the level of death and destruction that the North was. Above all, Rhee refused to give up the hope of reunification. In fact, Rhee became a real problem for the U.S. He organized mass rallies in his country, calling for a more aggressive stance, and lobbied conservative Americans to pursue victory. A stumbling block in the peace negotiations was the exchange of prisoners. Some North Korean and Chinese prisoners did not want to go home, but the Chinese and the DPRK insisted that they all be returned. Rhee attempted to sabotage the peace negotiations by releasing Chinese and North Korean prisoners. The Americans became so frustrated with Rhee that they drew up a secret plan to remove him from office and replace him with someone easier to work with. But it was never carried out. On July 27, 1953, the UN, China, and North Korea signed an armistice that was enacted without Rhee's signature. Division made permanent. The impact of the war on Koreans. The Korean War could be characterized as a war in which almost everyone lost. Pyongyang and Seoul both failed in their efforts to reunify the country. The Americans stopped South Korea from falling to the communists at a cost of 40,000 lives, but they ended up where they did not want to be, stuck in the peninsula, with the threat of the resumption of war always present. The war didn't cost the Soviets much, but they didn't gain anything either. It did not divert U.S. attention from Europe. China could claim some success. Defending an ally and fighting the Americans to a draw may have enhanced the prestige of the new regime, but it came at a cost of perhaps 300,000 Chinese lives. The war also preserved an ally that would later prove troublesome to the Chinese. It strengthened the U.S. military presence near their border, and it cost them Taiwan. When the war broke out, the U.S. sent its navy to defend the last province held by Chiang Kai-shek's nationalists, just as the PRC was about to take it. Most of all, the Korean people lost. Perhaps more than 1.5 million men, women, and children died in the war. The death and destruction were truly horrific. Yet the one thing almost all Koreans wanted, reunification, was now farther away than ever. For the DPRK in particular, the war was a disaster. The country was in ruins. Just how many lives were lost is uncertain. It is estimated that up to 8 or even 10% of the population perished, a casualty toll matched by few countries in modern history. The war was certainly a failure for the regime, since rather than reunifying the country on its own terms, it ended up strengthening both the South Korean regime and the U.S. commitment to defend it. The failure of the South Korean people to rise up and support the KPA must have been a demoralizing blow to Kim and his comrades. Even more troubling was the passive response of the people in the North to the occupying ROK forces. The extent of death and destruction was not as great in the South, but still horrible. Seoul was a jumble of half-standing buildings and rubble. More than 200,000 South Korean soldiers were killed, along with at least an equal number of civilians. Tens of thousands of South Koreans, mostly young men, but also intellectuals and others of varying ages, were taken to the North and never seen or heard from again. Millions of South Koreans were forced to flee, forming one of the world's largest refugee populations. Perhaps most tragic were the millions of South Koreans who were now totally cut off from family members. In most cases, they would never learn what became of their siblings, parents, children, or spouses. Not only was the Korean War a bad war for almost all, it didn't end. The agreement in July 1953 was only a ceasefire. It certainly didn't end for Kim Il-sung, who never gave up his plans for reunification. Over the next several decades, he sought to learn from his mistakes and prepare for final victory. And what were the lessons? To make sure his country was militarily and industrially strong enough to carry out a war without Allied support. To make sure the citizens of the Democratic People's Republic were well indoctrinated, so they would give all their efforts and would not cooperate with the enemy. to foster the revolutionary forces in the South until the people were ready to turn against their regime and support the North, and to gain international support for his efforts at reunification and prevent the U.S. from interfering. These goals are exactly what his regime worked to achieve. The war didn't end for the South, either. It left the Republic of Korea with one of the world's largest armed forces, 600,000 citizens under arms, and with a large U.S. military presence in their country. It hardened the attitudes of many in South Korea who were outraged by the North Korean invasion and appalled at the way its occupation had conducted itself. An entire generation of South Koreans was now ardently anti-communist and pro-U.S., and even if they were often critical of the government in power, they accepted the legitimacy of the Republic of Korea as the real successor to the historical Korean state. Unlike the leadership of the North, South Korean leaders knew that they could not reunify the country by force. But like their northern counterparts, they believed that they had to create an industrially and militarily strong society that would eventually be able to achieve victory in a renewed conflict. Both Koreas would now engage in an economic development race to better prepare themselves for the next outbreak of fighting, while at the same time demonstrating the superiority of their system to their own people and to their neighbors across the demilitarized zone.